Observer.org. You're listening to Observer Radio. I'm your host, Jonathan McNamara. Each week, our half-hour program features writers from the Texas Observer and other esteemed guests for a conversation about the biggest issues in Texas politics and culture. This week on the show, we're joined by Observer Associate Editor Forrest Wilder, who flat-out refused to make a fool of himself at karaoke last night, and as we sent off a mutual colleague. Forrest, any chance we're going to get a song on the air today?
Well, Jonathan, it depends on the request. Ooh. But science or my magic eight ball says no.
Not likely.
Not science likely.
Point to no. Later in the show, we'll be joined by author Wes Ferguson to discuss his book, Running the River, Secrets of the Sabine, excerpted in the July issue of the Texas Observer. Then we'll let Mr. Ferguson flow on about his upcoming project, another river book, this time about the Blanco River. But before we soak up knowledge about Texas rivers, we've got a very important topic to discuss this week. Immigrant children. I'm betting you're aware of the massive influx of immigrants from Central America and that many of them are children. Children, some say, pose a disease threat. But as the Observer points out in a story from late last week, that supposed threat is wildly overstated. Here to help us get a better grasp on the facts of this situation is Rachel Pearson, a writer and an MD PhD student at the Institute for the Medical Humanities and the University of Texas Medical Branch. Rachel, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, point blank, here's the question. How big of a disease threat do these immigrant children actually pose?
These immigrant children do not pose a disease threat. Threat's really not the right way to think about this at all. We should be concerned about their health, particularly because they've made a long journey, they've come from places with violence, and they're being kept in detention centers where they may not have access to adequate hand washing facilities and enough space and the kind of exercise and clean air that kids need.
Right.
So we should be concerned about, you know, them getting sick because of the conditions they're being kept in. But in terms of them making Texans sick, in terms of them being a disease threat to any communities where they might be housed, we really do not need to worry about that.
How do American vaccination rates compare to those in Central America?
Yeah, so it's a really good question. I was concerned about the some of the media coverage about these kids with respect to their health because people were saying things that were flat out false. So people were talking about these kids bringing measles mm-hmm. into the States, talking about them having no vaccinations, no vaccination records. There's no way we could know. They could be bringing back diseases that we've eradicated here in the United States. As a matter of fact, in Central America, the rates of vaccination are very comparable to here in the United States. And if you look, for example, at measles, 93% of kids in Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala are vaccinated against measles. In the United States, the rate is 92%. So those facts should lead us to two conclusions. Number one, these kids don't have measles. They don't have vaccine-preventable diseases. And number two, even if they did, our vaccination rates are generally good enough that they couldn't really cause a big outbreak of measles here.
So, Rachel, I mean, I think that that's surprising probably to a lot of people. I have to say I was surprised. I thought probably, you know, vaccination rates in Texas and the U.S. would be, you know, significantly higher than the Central American countries because they are much poorer. They don't have the same health infrastructure in some respects that we think the U.S. does. So how can these rates be comparable? Do they just have good vaccination programs? And how's it compared to Texas in particular?
Yeah, so the vaccination rates are good because they have pretty good access to medical care, which is something that we don't really have here in Texas. A sixth of Texan kids are uninsured even after the implementation of the Affordable Care Act. So lots and lots of kiddos in Texas don't get vaccinations on time or fall behind in their vaccine schedule because they don't have good access to care. Now, not all of these Central American countries have universal health care, but Guatemala does. And in most Central American countries, even folks who are pretty poor can access basic medical care. Now, that brings up this interesting question or this interesting issue. Because, like you're saying, these countries are poorer and they don't have the same health infrastructure. So kids in Central America they may be able to get vaccinated, but then they may not have access to the kind of clean water, healthy, safe food, stuff that most kids in Texas can get, even if they can't get medical care. So all those countries have a higher infant and child mortality rate, and kids are at risk for being sick because of public health issues. But in terms of access to care, they're doing really well. Access to medical care is super, super important. But I do think that one of the reasons that Texan kids have, you know, a lower mortality rate and in some ways are a lot healthier is because of our good public health infrastructure.
So there's been a smattering, or more than a smattering, really, there's been a number of news reports over the past few weeks that have to do not with infectious diseases so much as reports of things like chickenpox, the flu, scabies, head lice. Some of the reports have been fairly alarming. At least an inference I think you're supposed to draw is that this is really frightening, and that we have something to fear from these problems that are mostly being detected, as I understand, in detention facilities.
Yeah, so people are definitely trying to make us be afraid of this plague of kids. And that fear is playing on a historical narrative of tying immigration to disease. So the fact that you and I, even as a health professional, were surprised that these kids, you know, were very likely vaccinated, that's part of that popular perception that developing countries, people are like so sick. And then that in turn is tied up in this fear that immigrants will bring disease. If you look at that, the history of that idea that immigrants bring disease, it's been a very problematic narrative in American history. When people think of immigrants as having a lot of diseases or being a disease threat, that is a way of turning them against immigrants. It can lead to, you know, some really unsound and inhumane policies. So
I think you mentioned Typhoid Mary. It might be maybe the most famous example in U.S. history of what you're talking about, this immigrant as a disease vector.
Yeah, so Mary Mallon was an immigrant cook living in New York City in the early 1900s. She's the woman who we know as Typhoid Mary. And she, you know, was carrying typhoid. This was right around the time of the bacteriological revolution. So we were just starting to be able to, you know, identify and isolate bacteria and like see them under a microscope and know. And so Typhoid or Mary Mallon came along around then, and she did, like the people that she was working for, she was working as a cook, the people that she was working for were infected with typhoid. She also was infected with typhoid. But the response to this outbreak of disease that centered around her was very punitive. She was imprisoned for life. And so nobody was like, poor Mary Mallon, she has this terrible disease. Because she was an immigrant, like the people that she was working for who were like wealthier New Yorkers, their disease, their getting infected was seen as a tragedy, whereas Mary Mallon's was seen as something that is her fault that she should be punished for. And so, again, we're seeing that kind of narrative played out with these kids where if they have an infection, it's their fault. It makes them scary. It makes them a threat to us.
And it's interesting. I mean, I remember like 2005, 2006, there was another one of these outbreaks, if you will, of hysteria around immigrants and disease. I remember leprosy was one of the things that was talked about. And there were some bogus citations to medical literature that was not peer-reviewed and was pretty thoroughly debunked. But I guess what I'm wondering is why the kids? I mean, we still have plenty of adults crossing the border. We have at varying levels for a long time, but it really seems that at this moment,
the public perception is kind of focused on the kids.
Yeah, it's really focused. Yeah. It's like the kids are the site where people are really worried about, you know, to the exclusion of what I guess their parents or other people. You know, economic immigrants from Mexico or wherever.
Does that stem from the fear that they're going to be entering our public school systems?
You know, I really don't know. You would think that children would be more sympathetic and would merit more sympathy from Texans in general than other immigrants, but I've been surprised actually at how vociferous the reaction against these children has been.
Well, I actually think that's a really good point, because those two things seem like they're separate, but actually they're really related. I mean, there's the hysteria just in general about the disease, but then you hear this other thing, oh, they're going to overwhelm our school systems.
Heard the same thing from Katrina as well.
Right. I think maybe this is just speculation, but the reason why the disease thing has caught on with the kids is because what else do you say? I mean, it's there are other things that they're not really kids. They're I don't know, wearing costumes or something. Or there's another one that's catching on is, well, a lot of them are 15 to 17-year-old boys, and those aren't kids, right? They don't count as kids. They're, you know, quasi-adults or something. But I do think that it's, in general, it's kind of hard to pick on kids. So you can talk about disease almost like disembodied from the individuals.
Yeah, one of the if you don't mind, I wanted to speak a little bit to some of the tropical diseases that people have been talking about popping up.
I was going to ask, because you mentioned in your piece about dengue fever, and some people have voiced concerns that these immigrant children are bringing that over, when, of course, dengue fever is carried by mosquitoes, which have the benefit of flight for spreading.
Yes.
let's talk about some of these tropical diseases.
Yeah, so the tropical diseases that people mentioned, dengue, like you said, Chagas, chikungunya, these are all diseases.
Even the names are scary.
They are pretty scary.
These are all diseases that require an animal vector, so like a mosquito, or in the case of Chagas, the kissing bug. Mm-hmm. Sounds friendly, but you know, you really don't want to encounter one. And so the epidemiology of any of those tropical diseases coming to Texas is more complicated than just some people coming here bringing the disease in their blood. And in addition to the fact that an animal host would have to come here, or a vector would have to come here as well, the most likely, well, lots of people travel back and forth legally just for vacations, or, you know, migrate in a documented way. Any of those people, any of us, I've been to Mexico a bunch, could also be infected with something like dengue. And then, you know, the scientists who are really studying dengue and chikungunya and Chagas, a lot of whom are at UTMB, have noted like the very gradual migration of these diseases, and that these epidemiological changes are gradual. So any particular upswing in migration of people can't explain, you know, a change in the pattern of tropical diseases we see. And I would also finally note that we did see our first documented case of chikungunya in Texas this past week. And it was just a dude from Austin who had traveled to the Caribbean and got infected with chikungunya.
Well, isn't it always a dude from Austin?
I know. Dude from Austin, if you're out there, I'm sorry you have chikungunya.
Very sorry.
You know, one other thing that is kind of a side note to this that's interesting is that, you know, we've written about this in The Observer, is this sort of backlash against vaccinations that's very popular at the moment. Among different groups of people, some religious groups, some homeschool types, and then also among more, I guess, more like off the grid, I don't know what the right terminology to use is, like hippie, let's say, types. And we saw actually not that long ago a pretty major outbreak of measles at a church, centered on a church in North Texas. This problem with vaccinations or lack thereof is actually kind of a homegrown problem to some extent.
Absolutely. So, my sense is that most of the shortfalls in vaccination in Texas have to do with poverty, because if you look at the county by county vaccination rates, the rates are lower in the poorest counties. However, when there's a group of people that culturally don't vaccinate, that cluster in a school or cluster in a church, that group of people can be very susceptible to a measles outbreak. Say one kid travels to France where there's, you know, still plenty of measles, comes back, and then you see an outbreak like we did see in that church. Vaccination, I have studied this because, like, I was really interested in the narratives of people who don't vaccinate, and I was like, well, maybe there's some science behind it, but the level of evidence that vaccination is safe and effective is so high that most researchers compare people who don't vaccinate to people who deny the truth of the theory of evolution or deny that climate change is happening. Like, so it's that good of a body of evidence. Yeah, so yeah, lots of our neighbors.
Real quick, we're almost out of time here. I wanted to ask you about what's been happening since your original story was published. It's my understanding that certain public health officials have come out and stated things about this. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, totally. It's been good because they backed up what we said.
That's always a good thing.
Yeah. So the docs who are down in the border have said that most of what they're seeing is normal childhood complaints and stuff like ankle injuries.
Is that communicable? Ankle injuries?
Probably not.
Probably not. The department, the DSHS,
Department of State Health Services.
Thank you, Forrest. Sure. Did release like a number of cases. So among the 57,000 kids who've been detained in Texas, they've seen 3 cases of flu, 23 cases of chickenpox, and 3 cases of tuberculosis. So flu, normal childhood illness, we need to be very careful that we don't get, you know, an epidemic situation and unsanitary conditions in a detention center, but you know, we can handle that. Number 2, tuberculosis. That's a serious disease. We need to continue screening those kids for it. And I think our health officials are doing a pretty good job there. With respect to the chickenpox, the United States is one of only a handful of countries nationwide that vaccinate for chickenpox. It's a pretty mild disease. Like, most European countries don't vaccinate for chickenpox. Central American countries don't vaccinate for chickenpox. It's us and Japan and a couple other people. And so, again, it's a bummer for these kids who are far from their families who are getting chickenpox, those 23 out of 57,000 kids. And I feel for them, but vaccination rates in Texas are 90% for chickenpox. And so I'm not worried about them infecting Texans.
Well, Rachel, thank you very much for being on the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Observer Radio, a half-hour news show from the folks at the Texas Observer. For his latest book, Running the River, Wes Ferguson traversed the Sabine River in Texas to take an intimate look at what life is like there. And for those of us who have not read through this work, we're very lucky to have him here with us in the studio to talk about it. Wes, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us to discuss Texas Rivers is Observer, Managing Editor, and Nature Enthusiast. Yeah, that's right. That's what I called you. Brad Tyer. Brad, thanks for being on the show.
Always happy to be here.
So, Wes, just to kind of start us off, I was wondering if you could tell us what inspired you to write this first book.
Well, I grew up by the Sabine River, went to a school district called Sabine Schools all my life. But I had never gone to the river before. I didn't know anyone who canoed it or paddled it or fished there or anything. But one day I was driving into work at my job at the Longview News Journal at the time, and I saw the water flowing around the bend as I crossed the bridge, and I started to think, I wonder what might come around that bend. I had no idea what might be on this river.
And so you took it upon yourself to explore and find out.
Yeah, a buddy and I, a fine art photographer named Jacob Croft-Botter, borrowed a boat, and we set off. We had no idea what to expect, what we might find, but we knew we had a week to kill on this river. So the plan was just to, you know, pack up the fishing poles and the camping gear and lots of bug spray and see what we might find.
Brad, is that how planning for fishing trips or river trips usually goes?
I don't know. I don't know why anybody would plan anything on the Sabine River. It was one of the first places I ever did a little bit of canoeing when I got a canoe a decade or so ago. And I didn't do a lot of canoeing on the Sabine. It was down where Tin crosses it on the lower part of the river. And it's, you know, creepy backwaters. We'd go through a channel, and hidden back there was like an alcoa plant, and you see alligators. Mm-hmm. And it's not a recreational river. In the sense of like a Guadalupe River or a Frio or one of these hill country kind of freestone streams. But it's sort of a mysterious river, and it's a great idea for a book because I don't think a lot of people run it. But when you got out on the river, you started meeting people who live on the river and make their living on the river. That might have not been what you were expecting. Tell me about the folks you ran into.
Yeah, we ran into this really interesting subculture of people who call themselves river rats. They have their trot lines and shacks. We met people living on the banks of the river without any electricity or running water, just living very simple lives. They'd have their shotgun for squirrel meat, and then in deer season they would stock up on venison. and then have gardens in it. They lived the same way that people in East Texas lived 100 years ago. And whereas all...
Probably my relatives, actually.
Yeah, our ancestors. Right. And they're kind of this remnant population that kind of captured the way that the whole region used to live, but that has slipped away.
Mm-hmm. That's always been one of my kind of favorite things about getting out on whatever river is, you see people's backyards. You know, you see people living in a way that by land, unless you go to the end of that long driveway, and that's not a great idea in Texas a lot of times, you can't, there's no access to that. So the river's the best way to kind of see that. You're getting out and meeting some of these folks, you know, according to the book, some pretty extensive profiles. How was that kind of crawling up on a bank out of a boat, uninvited, and meeting these folks?
Yeah, well, what we would do, you know, we'd come around a bend, and if we saw people up on the bank, we'd wave, and if they waved back and seemed pretty friendly, we'd pull over and then call up, you know, hey, can we come up and talk to y'all? And some people, you know, they wanted their privacy, they liked being out in the middle of nowhere, and they didn't want to talk to us, and those people, we would just say, okay, you know, have a nice life.
Mm-hmm.
But if they seemed friendly and were receptive, then we would come hang out and get them to tell us their stories, and if they were really interesting or just really great people, then we'd set up our camp and just hang out with them for a while.
Mm-hmm. And you open the book with an incident that falls outside of that, you know, hey, are you friendly? Hey, are you not friendly? I don't want to give it away. You want to tell that story?
Yeah. So we were south of Toledo Bend, boating down the river, and we see four people up on this really tall bluff just sitting there, and we wave. They all wave back. So we pull over, and when we pull up to the bank, we hear this pop, 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 and this gunshot just spattering the river, and we freeze.
Smart, right?
Right. And
good reaction.
Yeah, and so, I mean, we're like, are they shooting at us? I think so. And so we called up, hey, we just want to come talk to y'all. And they said, they're like, yeah, come on up. Sorry for shooting at y'all. We thought you was our brother. And Jacob, the photographer, he kind of turns to me and murmurs, I don't think that makes it any better.
Right. Did you ever figure out what the brother had done? Did you get to hang out with these folks, or did you think better of it and move on downstream?
Well, we didn't have a lot of time with them, and I, you know, I didn't want to offend this trigger happy guy sitting there with his, you know, he had a semi-automatic 22 across his lap. but he said that his brother had a boat just like ours.
Uh-huh.
And, mm-hmm. you know, I didn't want to pry too much.
It's probably wise.
That's probably a good move. Mm-hmm.
So did you guys, the river trip reads pretty seamlessly in the book. Was it one long river trip, or did you break it up into sections and go back and like revisit people a second time, or how did the logistics work?
Well, Jacob and I took two main trips. The first was about a week that we spent on the upper portion of the river,
mm-hmm.
through northeast Texas in the Piney Woods. And then I took a series of trips by myself along the middle portion of the river and filling in the gaps in different areas.
Mm-hmm.
And then Jacob and I spent another week traveling from Toledo Bend on down the Texas-Louisiana border and into the Gulf of Mexico.
Mm-hmm. So what did you, you started off with this curiosity about what's around the next bend. What was around the next bend? What was the most, aside from getting shot at, what were the things that you discovered on that river that you hadn't known growing up near it, but not really exploring it? What did you find that you hadn't known?
Yeah, well, the most rewarding part was meeting these really interesting people that, you know, live in my backyard that I had never met before. But I also learned a lot about the important and vital role that the Sabine River and that all Texas rivers play in the environment for, you know, in purifying our drinking water and cleaning the water that and during flood times,
mm-hmm.
And then also the way that the dams that are there are several dams on the Sabine River and how those have really been detrimental to the river,
mm-hmm.
and how it's kind of a cautionary tale to encourage people to look for other water sources before damming some of our other rivers throughout the state.
Are there proposals on the docket for further dams on the Sabine?
There are a couple of options that are, you know, on the big list, but it doesn't seem like those are going to be happening anytime soon.
Mm-hmm. The and talk about the water quality a little bit. The Sabine is one of those naturally muddy, mm-hmm. kind of tannin-colored rivers. It doesn't look clean. It doesn't look clear. But judging from the book, it's actually a relatively non-polluted, improved water quality river.
That's true. I mean, you look at it, and it's dark and nasty looking, and you think, like, oh, my God, it's just swimming with pollutants and stuff. But the tests that have been done on the river don't really show that at all. It's, you know, it's through a very rural area, and mm-hmm. it doesn't have the same pollution problems, at least on the upper portion. Once you start getting lower toward Sabine Lake and going through Orange, then you start picking up more of that, you know, E. coli and some of the, you know, dissolved oxygen and other mm-hmm. issues. But no, it's one of the cleaner rivers despite its appearance.
Right. Interesting. Okay.
I've got a question. I know that you're working on another book about the Blanco River, and mm-hmm. I was wondering if you could give us a little compare contrast on those experiences. Has it been very different?
Yeah, it's the opposite. It's interesting you call it the Blanco. The people who live there all say Blanco, and they know that you're an outsider because you pronounce
totally it. I'm totally an outsider.
I've done that too. I switch back and forth.
Blanco. Don't pronounce it the correct way.
Okay.
But yeah, it's a much shorter river. It's clear and pristine, and it's, you know, trickling over limestone cliffs, and, you know, lots of falls. And we've been paddling the river. And now that it's summertime, it's so low that we're doing a lot more walking and wading along the river.
I was about to say, the character is dramatically different here. You go over in East Texas, there's water in the rivers regularly as a matter of course. Mm-hmm. And you get in West Texas, you got to wait for the rains before the rivers come up enough to really paddle them. So the role in the communities they go through is probably pretty dramatically different too.
Right. And the Blanco is interesting too because it is constantly flowing in and out of the aquifer because there are so many fault zones along the river. Mm-hmm. There are places where there are huge springs where the water is, you know, surging up from the Trinity Aquifer, and then other places where it's dipping back down into the Edwards and supplying flow to even like Barton Springs.
Mm-hmm. Right on. Well, the book is called Running the River. That's Wes Ferguson's book about the Sabine River. You can find out more about that and read an excerpt of it on TexasObserver.org. Wes, thank you so much for being on the show.
Glad to be here. Thanks a lot.
And Brad, thank you as well.
Yeah, thank you.
We've unfortunately reached the end of this episode, but before we go, I'd like to thank Rosie and the Ramblers for providing our music. And of course, a big thanks to all of you out there listening to us. Observer Radio is recorded at the lovely Co-op Radio Studios in Austin, Texas. Our sound engineer is Tracy Schulz. For more Texas news and culture, you can visit us on the web at texasobserver.org or pick up a copy of the latest Texas Observer at a store near you. We'll talk to you again next time on Observer Radio.